loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, yesterday was day one in the trial of former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort, who has been charged with 18 felonies related to financial crimes. The Washington Post said that the Justice Department prosecutor was using a scorched earth policy, making bold, unproven assertions and telling jurors that Manafort's profligate spending should be held against him. Meanwhile, Special Counsel Mueller has sent three cases to federal prosecutors, including Democrats Tony Podesta and Greg Craig, who served as counsel to President Obama. Next, activists around the world are deeply concerned that Julian Assange could be evicted from the Ecuadorian embassy in London soon. Recent comments from Ecuador's new president, Lenin Moreno, suggest that a deal with British authorities is in the works. Then the Trump administration moved today to promote short-term junk insurance plans, further undermining the Affordable Care Act. Meanwhile, the debate over single-payer health care has heated up after a controversial new study was released by the Mercatus Center, funded by the billionaire Koch brothers. And then the Trump administration is considering a second sharp reduction in the number of refugees who can be settled in the United States, further scaling back a program that is meant to protect the world's most vulnerable people. And this time, there isn't any notable opposition inside the White House. And finally, a far-right Brazilian presidential candidate, Jair Bolsonaro, said yesterday that his country should not feel guilty about its past as the world's most prolific slave importer, adding that Brazil, quote, owes no debt, unquote, to its black citizens. The 63-year-old congressman added that if elected, he would repeal laws implemented during the presidency of Dilma Rousseff that are aimed at reducing inequality in Brazil. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to the Manafort trial. Yesterday was day one in the trial of former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort, who has been charged with 18 felonies related to financial crimes. The Washington Post said today that the Justice Department prosecutor was using a scorched earth policy, making bold, unproven assertions and telling jurors about Manafort's profligate spending. The prosecutor was twice admonished by Judge T.S. Ellis III to stick to the facts. Meanwhile, Special Counsel Mueller has sent three cases to the federal prosecutors, including Democrats Tony Podesta and Greg Craig, who served as counsel to President Obama. We're joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He's a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Welcome back, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel, we're a day and a half now into this trial. It's been going on most of the day today. And Judge Ellis has twice admonished the prosecutors. But the Washington Post went out of its way this morning to say that you can't really judge what Judge Ellis is going to do based on what Judge Ellis says. So how do you think it's going so far for the prosecution and for the defense?
Well, I agree with the Washington Post, strangely enough. I mean, you know, these things aren't predictable. You really can't tell, you know, what Ellis is up to. But I think his objections, his rulings have been totally on target. I mean, terms like oligarch and going on about Manafort, the very expensive watch. I mean, this is just nonsense. I mean, America is an oligarchy, and America is a place where rich people sport, you know, very expensive watches, jewelry, clothing, mansions, you know what. You know, you name it. So I think this is a highly prejudicial on Ellis. I think it's quite right in slapping it down. So maybe Manafort will get a fair trial, but doesn't mean this whole prosecution is not politically tainted like anything.
There was another announcement that came today from the Justice Department saying that they may not call Rick Gates to testify against Manafort after all. He was supposed to be their star witness. What do you think that's all about?
It could mean their case is weak. I mean, I don't know. I mean, like, knowing, I mean, this whole thing to me is just very smelly. I mean, would Manafort be in the situation he is in now if there hadn't been for this anti-Russia hysteria? I mean, the answer is obviously not. This prosecution is political, obviously political, and they're trying to nail this guy for political reasons, and maybe their case is not very strong.
Daniel Lazar is our guest. Daniel is a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. We're talking about the Paul Manafort trial. Paul Manafort was briefly Donald Trump's campaign chairperson. He was fired by Trump in the summer of 2016 at the very time that the Russia investigation was going forward. forward. Now we have the Starr trial. This is in a way, Daniel, like the Marquis trial. That's the term we used yesterday for the Mueller probe. Manafort was doing business in Ukraine and was connected with Yanukovych, who is the now deposed, democratically elected but corrupt leader of Ukraine, who was trying to, unlike what the U.S. media says, he was trying to kind of position himself between East and West, between Russia and the EU or the EU and the United States. He was overthrown in a U.S.-backed coup d'etat in 2014. Manafort is arrested later after Trump comes into office. He's indicted on all of these tax evasion charges and fraud charges, hiding money charges. And the government promises the judge at the beginning, oh, we promise we won't talk about Russia. Now, wouldn't the Mueller probe, if this is the Marquis trial linking Russia to Trump and the Russian collusion, and he's the Trump chairman for a while of the Trump 2016 campaign, wouldn't Russia figure prominently in this prosecution?
Look, Mueller has handed down three major indictments. He's handed down an indictment against Manafort, against the Internet Research Agency in St. Petersburg, and against 12 members of the Russian Intelligence Service, the GRU. The latter two will never, he did not intend the latter two to ever come to trial. To his surprise, one of the indictees in the first case, in the Internet Research Agency, actually showed up in Washington and demanded a trial, and Mueller apparently panicked and has pleaded for more time to assemble his own facts. And it's very, very funny because the St. Petersburg company, which is known as the Concord Consulting, I believe, has hired a very aggressive attorney who is going after Mueller, hammer and tongs, very aggressive in demanding information from the U.S. government, showing up the political nature of this whole prosecution. Now, with Manafort, he's not accused of collusion. The guy is accused of wrongdoing that wrong proceeds his time as Trump's campaign chairman, and would never have arisen if this whole hysteria had not cropped up. This is the political nature of this whole prosecution. Look, Manafort is a really, really bad guy, but I'm rooting for him. I hope the guy gets off because the prosecution is so obviously political.
Yeah, Daniel Lazar is our guest. We're talking about day two of the Paul Manafort trial. John Kiriakou, I'm looking at the Washington Post from just now. Mm-hmm. It says Donald Trump calls Manafort prosecution a hoax. Says Sessions, that's Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, should stop Mueller investigation, quote, right now. Now, earlier today, when I was coming into the studio here, I was looking at CNN, and the headline with the chyron at the bottom was Trump distancing himself from Manafort. Now, here we are several hours later. Trump calls Manafort prosecution a hoax. Anyway, this is, of course, going to be trashed by MSNBC and CNN, who will say this is Donald Trump once again trying to obstruct justice.
Sure.
But what do you think, John?
This is what Donald Trump does. You and I probably believe that it's obstruction of justice. He either doesn't believe it or doesn't care. But he's been saying the same thing really since this investigation began. He said in the beginning that he really didn't even know Paul Manafort. And in fact, he didn't know him very well. He knew him for 6 months. And then when he found out that Manafort was under investigation, he blew up at Corey Lewandowski on the Trump helicopter saying, we hired a criminal to run our campaign. So I think he's in the sort of the final stages of self-preservation. And he just wants this thing to go away. He thinks that he can help it go away by calling it a hoax and by criticizing it.
And Daniel Lazar, the other part of it is that Donald Trump has very, very high ratings among Republicans, the highest of any Republican politician for a long time. I think he believes that this is a hoax, and he believes that the Russia thing is a witch hunt. We disagree with Donald Trump on almost everything,
sure,
but I actually believe this is what he thinks. And certainly it's what his base thinks, his political base in the Republican Party. 1 minute left.
I 80% agree with Trump. I mean, there's some possibility, and it's not 100%, that the Russian intelligence didn't really hack the DNC. But, you know, it's really what it amounts to is another question. And there's no doubt that there is a hysterical campaign, an anti-Russian campaign that's going on now, that which is totally taken leave of the facts. It's exceeded the facts many times over. And Trump is right. This is a political campaign. It's not a criminal investigation. It's a political campaign. And I think he's basically in the right ballpark.
Yeah, I think the country is kind of coming to that same conclusion little by little. Anyway, that was the voice of Daniel Lazar. He joined us from New York. Daniel is a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Activists around the world are deeply concerned that Julian Assange could be evicted from the Ecuadorian embassy in London soon. Recent comments from Ecuador's new president, Lenin Moreno, suggest that a deal with British authorities is in the works. We're joined from Berlin by activist and journalist Diani Barreto, and we're joined from New York by Randy Credico. Randy is an activist, a comedian, and the former director of the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice. Welcome to both of you.
Hey, it's great to be on the show. Thank you.
Glad to be back. Thank you.
Randy, you operate in these circles around Julian. What are you hearing from friends of his, colleagues, attorneys, anybody that you're talking to?
Well, you know, it's a mixed signal that I'm getting. I really don't know, and I don't think they know exactly what is in the works for Julian. I spoke to John Pilger last night. He's in Australia. You know, he's concerned about Prime Minister Turnbull not helping out. You know, you talk to people in London, they're outside. You talk to some of the lawyers, or you hear some of the lawyers, and, you know, you get all sorts of opinions and projections. At this point, it's so confusing, I can't make any authoritative statement about it, to be honest with you, other than the fact that people are really galvanized now. They're mobilizing, they're coalescing, there are demonstrations, there are vigils. I'm speaking at one today over the phone in San Francisco at the Ecuadorian embassy. So I really don't know what the fate is. And I think maybe Lenin maybe backing off a little bit. You see that one day, the next day, it looks like he's not backing off. So the whole thing is a conundrum.
Diani, there are a lot of vigils and sit-ins and activities to try to bring attention to Julian's plight. I know that there's a very important one this weekend where it's going to be live streamed on YouTube. And I think it's the fourth or fifth. I've participated in several of them so far. What can you tell us about that or about other events that people can participate in to support Julian?
There is a petition that was circulated today to all the elected members in Australia and to the Prime Minister, you know, pretty much asking Australia to step in at this very, very grave juncture. As Randy pointed out, very mixed signals, but this seems to be a very grave development here. I'll get back to answering your question just to maybe fill some people in. Lenin Moreno, the current president of Ecuador, has done some very strange things. Says he won't talk about it, then ends up talking about it, ends up negotiating with the UK, making statements in Spain. Very confusing, says one thing one day, does another. Well, that's how he ran on his platform. Essentially, he had been, you know, blessed by the former president and then, you know, completely turned pretty much right-wing. And the sanctity of asylum, a political asylum, has been upheld by the Inter-American Court, which is a very serious thing. He cannot legally revoke asylum or have him extradited, or as he sees it, ideally for Julian to do some time, or, you know, face the penalty in the UK and then to be extradited to a country where he, you know, he's not at risk. This is completely delusional. I don't know how he can possibly do this legally, because those opinions are binding. But it seems that since Pence went to go visit him, Vice President Pence, he wanted three things from Moreno. One, to isolate Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela, to make him like a pariah. Two, step away from those left-wing conventions and organizations, and to go gravitate to more right-wing organizations. And three, to extradite and revoke asylum of Julian Assange. So this seems very much to me that Ecuador is pretty much becoming another colony of the U.S., de facto U.S. empire. So now it's up to people to know what exactly is going on, what this principle of non-refoulement is, the cornerstone of asylum and international refugee law. He can't do that. You can't send people back to the country or to return them to the country where persecution or danger persists. Under espionage, anti-terror laws, Assange is likely to be charged with if he is indicted after the secret grand jury investigation and now after the Mueller indictment. These are capital offenses. He could face the death penalty. This is very, very serious. So it's now up to the supporters and legal experts and journalists worldwide to contact their elected officials, maybe contact Australia, sign those petitions. There's a petition also to the Pope to maybe accompany him so he has safe passage so nothing happens to him. Ecuador must offer him and commit to offering him safe passage. This is an amazing flagrant violation of international law. I'm just dumbfounded by this. And it appears sources are commenting that his health has worsened in the last couple of days. I mean, imagine that stress when, you know, you're maybe faced with the death penalty. So, yeah, very, very, very serious indeed.
Julian Assange is, and WikiLeaks publications, this media center, has been the source for, I would say, the news stories and news analysis and perhaps some of the most important stories for the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Guardian, you name it. All the leading lights in the mainstream media have been glad to avail themselves of and use WikiLeaks publications. Here we have a situation now that this media site, which has provided, you know, it's a truth-telling operation, basically. Now that Julian Assange is being perhaps expelled from the Ecuadorian embassy and then facing extradition, imprisonment in Britain and extradition to the U.S. where he could face life in prison or, as Diani is saying, even the death penalty. There's a deafening silence, a studied apathy, Randy, by the same media outlets that were very, very happy to use WikiLeaks as a source. I mean, an astounding level, a breathtaking level of hypocrisy.
Yes, absolutely. Not just silence, it's worse. They are participating, they are conspiring, they are supporting Julian Assange being extradited, basically. You even look at publications like The Intercept. You have two characters there, Micah Lee and this guy Gallagher, who have put out some of the nastiest comments. You know, we know what The Washington Post is going to do. We know what MSNBC, Ken Delaney, and these guys are going to do. But at the end of the day, they really should be circling the wagons rather than circling the firing squad around Julian Assange. Because what they're doing here, if Assange comes, they are to the U.S. and he is prosecuted, they are committing collective suicide. They really are. They should be out there because they're going to be next. They think, well, Assange is out of the way, we're protected. Well, some of them will be. Some of them will have golden parachutes because they've served their masters. But for the majority of journalists out there, they should be standing and be linebackers against these vicious attacks and this ongoing persecution of Julian Assange.
And Diani, you know, this is an important point too, just because the heat is on Julian right now, and let's assume a worst case scenario that he is actually arrested by the British and held until he's extradited to the United States. That doesn't mean that WikiLeaks just goes away. That doesn't mean that WikiLeaks stops doing its work, right?
Hopefully. I think that's the principle. Like it's like a hydra. You know, you can cut off the head, but it will continue. But at the same time, I think the grand jury, the so-called secret grand jury investigation, you don't know what those charges are and who they're going to be lodged against. Not even their lawyers are informed of those charges. So it depends if they go after Assange now, and are they going to go after the whole team and the legal team as well to halt all publications, future that could be in the works. We don't know.
Yeah, I think that's likely because this has been a primary demand of the American state apparatus is to get their hands on Julian Assange. And it's not just about him, the person. It's really to shut down WikiLeaks. I mean, that really is the effort. It's really to shut down alternative voices. I want to just read from, this is out from an hour ago, and it's not unusual, but again, for our audience that may not be paying as careful attention. This is from the Montreal Gazette 1 hour ago. Julian Assange will leave the Ecuadorian embassy in London, his refuge from criminal charges for the last 6 years, and enter a changed world. The Australian walked into the building in the capital's Knightsbridge neighborhood just before the 2012 Olympics with Barack Obama in his first term in elections untainted by alleged interference by Russian agents. When he walks out, Assange will face a new, more aggressive American president, a UK trying to find its role outside of the European Union, and a change in Ecuadorian leadership. The 47-year-old may find the future uncertain. You know what's sort of stunning about this article is it's all about politics. And it shows, Randy, that this is pure politics. And it's pure politics and the suppression of political truths. And it's done under the veneer of a legal process. But it's really, at the base, it's about politics.
Yeah, it really is. And by the way, you know, it's like William Kunstler said, there's no justice in or out of court. Yes, if he is extradited, he'll be brought over here. They'll give him a trial. He will lose it. They will fix it. And they'll say, well, you see, we gave him his due process. And so at the once again, at the end of the day, this is a very scary development. That is a very scary story that you just read. And it is politics. It's all about politics. Look, you know, let me just say about the election. A lot of these Democrats and these liberals are upset that he tilted the election. That's not what this is all about. They don't care about that. That is a veneer. That is window dressing. What they really care about is him exposing what the government does, the military does, the CIA does. They don't want him to do that. They don't care about this Russia election stuff. That's complete nonsense. They just don't want that kind of voice to get out there, that kind of ability. And yes, it would be a big blow to WikiLeaks if he is imprisoned. He is a very special journalist, one of a kind.
We're going to leave it there. We were joined from Berlin by activist and journalist Diani Barreto, and we were joined from New York by Randy Credico. Randy's an activist, a comedian, and the former director of the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Trump administration moved today to promote short-term junk insurance plans, further undermining the Affordable Care Act. Meanwhile, the debate over single-payer health care has heated up after a controversial new study was released by the libertarian Mercatus Center. We're joined from Nashville, Tennessee by Dr. Carol Paris. She's the president of Physicians for a National Health Plan. Dr. Paris, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I want to start with this new study claiming that single-payer health care would cost $32 trillion with a T. That just seems both unfathomable and grossly incorrect.
It's not right, because that kind of money should be saved for rich people in tax breaks.
or for war. We could spend
all
that on war.
Yeah, we should spend that on war. That's terrible. Anyway, but let's talk about the actual number, those $32 trillion.
Well, that's interesting, because that is a really scary number, and that's exactly what the Koch-funded Mercatus Center was hoping people would focus on. And what they're conflating is federal health spending and national health spending expenditures. And yes, federal health expenditures, if we went to a single payer health plan, would go up, but they would simply reflect national health expenditures. Right now, our national health expenditures are predicted to be anywhere from $32 trillion to upwards of $49 trillion over the next 10 years. And those national health expenditures include both federal spending and all of the spending that you and I engage in through premiums, copays, and deductibles. So all this is saying is if we had all of it coming out of a single payer, the federal government, then yes, the federal health expenditures would reflect our national health expenditures. And so it's really not saying anything. It's an accounting statement.
That's right.
It says absolutely nothing about the cost of health care. And in fact, if you dig into the details of the graphs, which I'm very happy that Matt Grunig and other people did, you actually find out that embedded in the study is clear evidence that a single-payer national health program would save, even with Mercatus's very, very conservative estimates, $2 trillion over 10 years. Our figures suggest that it's more like $12 trillion.
That's amazing. Again, the facts don't lie. The figures don't lie, but liars can figure.
That's right.
So
yeah.
I think that's what we're looking at here. And Bernie Sanders, who has also introduced single payer, has made the same point. He goes on the other end. It's more conservative. Carol's group is suggesting, Dr. Paris's group is suggesting maybe a $12 trillion in saving. Sanders is saying perhaps $3 trillion. What people don't know just how, well, people who are in the system, but a lot of people don't know just how expensive the healthcare here is. And almost all of it is absorbed by us, the patients, the people who have to go to doctors. Let's talk, Dr. Paris, about the new news, which is that the Trump administration is not only making available, but trumpeting, so to speak, promoting these new short-term junk insurance plans, also part of an effort to sink the Affordable Care Act.
Well, and as you said earlier, it also is designed to transfer more and more of the cost of health care to you and me, the consumers, because these junk plans are designed to be very affordable by covering very little.
Yeah. And, you know, another thing about this report, too, is it makes assumptions, very important assumptions that are figured into the numbers, figured into the pricing. For example, they're saying that they're using the number that Bernie Sanders is using for medical reimbursements, which is tied to Medicare. It's more than Medicaid, but it's less than private insurance. Well, you can fudge that number one way or the other, and there would be wild swings in the final cost of the program. So as Dr. Paris said, this study really doesn't tell us anything at all. It's just impossible to make any kind of determination because we don't really know what the numbers are going to be.
We don't know what the numbers are going to be, and we know that at its essence, these short-term health you shouldn't even be calling them health insurance plans because they're not even falling under the purview of the state insurance administration. So they're not regulated. And they can engage in all of the antics that pre-ACA insurance engaged in. No guaranteed issue, so they can deny you because they just think you may cost too much. They can have annual and lifetime caps on benefits, a very, very limited drug formulary. They can exclude maternity care, preventive care, mental health care, substance abuse. You know, they can do anything, pretty much anything they want. And who is that going to be attractive to?
Yeah.
It's going to be attractive to young, healthy people who are banking on staying young and healthy.
Well, let me ask you about that, actually.
I thought I was going to stay young and healthy.
You and me both. Dr. Paris, if you are young and healthy, let's say you're 22 years old, you just got out of college, you haven't been to a doctor in years because you haven't needed to, would this still be a junk policy, which is what critics are calling it? Or is this really a perfect cheap policy for somebody at that age who can then move into a better policy later?
Well, we probably should say, all right, we can take 22, but you know, if you're a lucky 22-year-old who has parents, you're still on their insurance if you're lucky enough to have parents.
Under the Affordable Care Act, that wasn't true until the Affordable
That's
Care
right.
Act.
Yeah, right. But let's say you're 22 and you're not covered under a parent's plan. Then it's the illusion of having protection. It is affordable. And as long as you stay young and healthy and you don't have a car accident that causes you to have serious injuries, you're going to have the illusion that you've made a really good deal here. The problem is, what if you do get hit by a truck and you don't die? Well, suddenly you're going to find out that the policy that you bought has an annual cap of $100,000. Well, how fast do you think you can burn through $100,000 with a couple of broken legs and a ruptured spleen? You're one major illness away from bankruptcy with these plans. And people just don't, they just don't realize that.
Yeah. You know, there's another part of what's going on right now, Carol, because we're running up to the midterm elections. And of course, here you have Trump and the Republicans doing, I mean, the Affordable Care Act was weak enough and bad enough as it was, but it was at least better than what came before it. And they're trying to undo it in all sorts of ways. I'm looking at a New York Times article, and the headline is, "After years of quiet, Democratic candidates can't stop talking about health care. A potent campaign theme emerges across the nation with a particular emphasis on pre-existing conditions." So Senator Claire McCaskill of Missouri asked voters at a big political dinner to stand up if they had a pre-existing condition. She had been hearing from voters at town hall meetings that they were worried about health care. The room was suddenly filled with standing voters. "Even I was stunned at just how few people kept their seats," she said. Like, no kidding. I mean, it's just so, of course, so many people have pre-existing conditions.
Yeah, we all do.
And the Democrats, because they're so, have been so loyal to the pharmaceutical companies or the insurance companies.
And the medical device companies.
Yeah, or the medical device companies. They've been quiet about this. Of course, this is a way to challenge the Republican or Trump plan, instead of focusing so much on Putin, like focus on people who have pre-existing conditions who aren't going to be able to go to a doctor now as a consequence of this administration's policies. Anyway, 90 seconds left, Dr. Paris.
Well, I in my 90 seconds, I would also like to point out that there are an awful lot of faux Medicare for All plans that people are going to be and have started hearing about. And I think this is something I want your listeners to pay very close attention to. Just because a plan has the word Medicare in it does not mean it is a single-payer Medicare for All plan. That is only H.R. 676 and to some degree Senate Bill 1804, Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All plan. But this plan called Medicare X, and then there's Medicare Extra for All, and there's even one called Medicare Advantage Premium Support for All. What a bunch of nonsense. Everybody, I mean, the brand, they're stealing the brand. If you could call dog food Medicare for All dog food, and suddenly everybody wants to have it, but it's not Medicare for All.
This is false advertising. These people should be arrested. They should be arrested, actually. It's criminal conduct.
They're trying to sell the public option in all kinds of nefarious ways and make people think that it's an incremental way to get to Medicare for All. And as PNHP has been saying for how many decades, it isn't just achieving universality. It's achieving it in a way that is fiscally viable going forward.
Yeah.
And the only way to do that is single payer.
And PNHA is Physicians for a National Health Plan. We're going to have to stop there. That was the voice of Dr. Carol Paris. She's president of Physicians for a National Health Plan. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Trump administration is considering a second sharp reduction in the number of refugees who can be resettled in the United States, further scaling back a program that is meant to protect the world's most vulnerable people. And this time, there isn't any notable opposition inside the White House. We're joined from Philadelphia by David Benyon. He's an immigration lawyer and executive director of the Free Migration Project. Dave, welcome back to the show.
Thanks again for having me.
Tell us about this proposed cut. This brings us back to the kinds of numbers that we were seeing during the Reagan administration in the 1980s. And there really doesn't seem to be any internal White House opposition because Stephen Miller, who really is the brains behind this this policy, has been able to replace the people who opposed the first cut in refugees.
Right. It's been reported in the New York Times today that the White House is considering this cut. And it does seem that Stephen Miller is ascendant and facing very little opposition. It's very unfortunate. The U.S. has historically brought in refugees, international legal obligations that the U.S. signed up to, and other countries coming out of World War II after the horrors of the Holocaust and other human rights abuses. They put into place this framework, which this administration now seems intent on dismantling, which has, I think, served, like you said, the most vulnerable people in need of protection well over the last decades and is now under attack by this administration.
You know, one of the things that surprised me, too, in this New York Times article, Dave, is the fact that, the State Department has traditionally been very supportive of refugees, increasing the number of refugees, resettling them all across the United States. I remember during the second Iraq War, we established large communities, for example, of Kurds in places like North Dakota or St. Louis, Missouri, and those communities have thrived since they arrived in this country. But there are now top Miller aides, former Miller aides, who are advising Mike Pompeo in senior positions at the State Department. And it seems like for the first time, at least in the last generation or so, the State Department may oppose the status quo and join the White House in supporting this cut in refugees. Is that what you're hearing?
That seems to be the case. And I think it's consistent with what we've seen across all of the cabinet departments, who any hint of opposition to the president's policies, and by association, Stephen Miller's anti-immigrant and anti-refugee policies, has either left or been replaced. And so what we're left with are people who, in general, support what really has been President Trump's go-to issue of demonizing immigrants and refugees. And, you know, it's interesting to see the White House's justifications that the Times articles report, which seem to more or less track security concerns, which just really exist even less in the refugee context than any other context because of the extremely rigorous and lengthy vetting process that any refugee who's resettled in the United States has to go through. So that security justification just falls flat. And then they also are saying, well, we're going to consider humanitarian visas and status as a whole, including asylum, temporary protected status, special immigrant juvenile status that certain unaccompanied minors can obtain. But that rationale is nonsense as well, because they're also in the process of attacking each of those programs separately. So it's crystal clear that their only objective is to decrease total numbers of refugees and immigrants in the United States.
Yeah. Another thing that this article noted that's important is that there's a backlog right now of 700,000 asylum requests. And the White House wants to let in, it's like zero of these 700,000 people, saying that they're all illegal immigrants, it says. They're all economic refugees. These are bogus asylum requests. The costs of doing security checks on all these people is astronomical. It's better just to throw them all out. Well, that's never been the policy of the American government in the past, to just throw everybody out while you're cutting the refugee ceiling from 50,000 to 25,000. Do you think that this is a trend, or is this a one-time policy change that the Trump administration wants so that they can declare victory and move on to something else?
It's definitely part of a trend. I mean, they want to get down to the point where, in that article, it's cited that John Kelly supposedly had said once privately that his ideal refugee cap would be somewhere between zero and one. And so, I mean, that's where we're headed. If they get their way, there will be no refugee admissions. All asylum seekers will have their due process rights curtailed to the full extent that the courts will permit, to essentially short-circuit the U.S.'s obligations not to send people back to countries where they could be tortured.
You know, John, the United States is a unique country in many ways, not unitarily unique, but pretty unique. The people who make up the population are either immigrants, or they're the indigenous native people, or their families came because they were enslaved as African people who were kidnapped from their homes in Africa. Those are the three main categories. Then there are people, also indigenous people, Mexicans who were happened to live in Texas or Arizona or California when the U.S. seized those territories and made them states, same with Alaska, same with Hawaii. If you're living in the United States, if you're a citizen in the United States, you come from one of those categories.
Yep.
The Statue of Liberty says, and Americans were always priding themselves on the idea that there was the land for persecuted people and for people fleeing. So the inscription at the base of the Statue of Liberty is, give us your tired, your huddled, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. This whole narrative about what America, what made America different, in some way would say in the, not us, but the exceptionalist, the American exceptionalist, this was one of its qualities. And yet now we have as a dominant policy, xenophobia, racism, hatred towards immigrants, hatred towards foreigners. That's what it really is. And it seems to me that this is going down without that much of an uproar from the, quote, mainstream media. Anyway, what's your opinion on that?
Yeah, it's hard to stand up to the barrage of these stories every week, sometimes multiple stories a week of some new way that the administration is attacking immigrant communities or scaling back existing programs or infringing on people's rights once again. So I understand to an extent that people get sort of outrage fatigue, but yes, I agree that this should not go unnoticed and unchallenged. And I think it's important. I'm glad that you guys are covering this because it's another step down that road towards a place that we really shouldn't be as a country.
One of the questions that I get all the time when we talk about these issues, you know, privately is what can people do to help? And I never really have a decent answer other than, you know, write your congressman. So what can people do to help?
So honestly, I think that the way that people can have the most impact is to look in your area. What are the on-the-ground groups that are fighting these campaigns for immigrant communities in your area? Those groups are probably running on a shoestring budget. They could use your financial support. They could use you to show up at rallies, to contact state and local politicians who may be able to influence policy decisions when we know that the Trump administration has put up a wall between the public and itself. And so that would be my suggestion. For instance, here in Pennsylvania, we're fighting to shut down the Burke Family Detention Center, and there are some local groups who are supporting that work. Same in Texas. In every other state, there are local groups who need your support and your assistance.
We're joined from Philadelphia by David Benyon. He is an immigration lawyer and executive director of the Free Migration Project. David, if you had a chance to go, if you had a chance to go on TV, on let's say one of the or all the networks, and you had 30 seconds to make this, to give a particular message to the people and try to sway them away from this rant and rage from the Trump administration against immigrants, what exactly do you say?
I would say that we're not being our best selves as a country and upholding the honorable tradition that we've had that really made the United States into what it is. Now, there have certainly been challenges and setbacks along the way. It's not been a perfect history, but this is really a radical departure, and it's designed really with one thing in mind, to keep America white, which is a lost cause, but they're going to try. When the Trump administration says, we want to go to a merit-based system, that's a lie with immigration, because they're also scaling back the merit-based systems that are already in place.
Precisely. We'll leave it there. We were joined from Philadelphia by David Benyon. He's an immigration lawyer and executive director of the Free Migration Project. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. A far-right Brazilian presidential candidate, Jair Bolsonaro, said yesterday that his country should not, quote, feel guilty, close quote, about its past as the world's most prolific slave importer, adding that Brazil, quote, owes no debt to its black citizens. The 63-year-old congressman added that if elected, he would repeal laws implemented during the presidency of Dilma Rousseff that are aimed at reducing inequality in Brazil. We're joined from Houston by Dr. Gerald Horn. Dr. Horn is a professor of history at the University of Houston, the author of many, many books, including The Deepest South, The United States, Brazil, and the African Slave Trade. Gerald Horn, welcome back.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. Dr. Horn, in this segment, we want to talk about both Bolsonaro's comments about slavery and the fact that Brazil need not apologize to the black Brazilians whose ancestors were brought in chains to Brazil. We're going to talk about that. We also want to talk about the current political situation in Brazil and the possibility even of a military coup d'etat in Brazil. But before we do that, I just want to get your take on his comments. Why did he say it? What does it mean? And what's the real situation with Brazil's history in the African slave trade?
Well, first of all, I don't think we should be surprised by his crude sentiments because in many ways they represent a strain of thinking right here in the United States of America. I think that if you were to walk outside of your studio in Washington, D.C., you could probably bump into more than one individual who would hold such backwards ideas. However, to set the record straight, it's fair to suggest that Portugal, which was the colonizing power in Brazil, and Portuguese is still the main language in Brazil, was a pioneer in terms of the African slave trade. It's striking to note that as early as the 1390s, you had Portuguese nationals involved in enslaving Africans. You had a significant percentage of the population of Lisbon, the capital of Portugal, being of African descent as early as the 1440s. And this is 50 years before Christopher Columbus. Understandably, we here in North America tend to associate slave trading with those who are English speakers, which is, as I said, understandable. But it's important to note that England doesn't become a major slave trading nation until the 17th century. And by then, Portugal and Spain, I should add, were head and shoulders above the rest. Now, what Mr. Bolsonaro, to give him the benefit of the doubt, might have been making reference to is that if you look at the figures, it's fair to suggest that responsible, interestingly enough, for the fact that so many enslaved Africans were brought to Brazil was the participation of U.S. nationals beginning in the 1830s, 1840s, and the early 1850s. But I doubt if he has that detailed history at his fingertips. And I think that a la United States, he was just making a bold attempt to appeal to the racist sentiments of a significant percentage of the Brazilian citizenry, not unlike the man who is his mirror image, Donald J. Trump. In fact, Steve Bannon, Mr. Trump's defrocked advisor, might have said about Mr. Bolsonaro, as he has said about others, that he was Trump before Trump was Trump. That is to say, it's a very dangerous current that's afloat in international politics today when politicians think that they can gain mileage by being racist.
Well, let's talk, Dr. Horn, about what this actually means in the context of what's going on in Brazil. You have the most powerful political figure in Brazil, that would be Lula, the founder of the Workers' Party, in prison on corruption charges, which he disputes. You have his heir, Dilma Rousseff, who won the election in 2014 with 53% of the vote, ousted by right-wing political elites, who I might add were the most corrupt political figures in Brazil. She's ousted from office. And now we have disarray in Brazil's political body politic. Lula in jail, perhaps as a consequence, will not be able to run for office or, if he wins, take office. And Bolsonaro appears to be, as an apologist for the old coup, the 1964 military coup that was backed by the United States, Bolsonaro appears to be perhaps a vessel for another military takeover in Brazil. Is it possible?
I'm afraid to say yes. It's very worrisome and very dangerous. Mr. Bolsonaro has organic ties to the Brazilian military, which, by the way, after that coup you made reference to, were involved in massive human rights violations, including the torture of one Dilma Rousseff, who, as you suggested, became Brazilian president before ousted in what could only be characterized as a coup a few years ago. Let us hope that Lula da Silva can run for president from prison. That is not unprecedented. Recall that Eugene Debs, the U.S. socialist leader, ran for president from prison some 90-odd years ago and did fairly well. And certainly this idea of running from prison was also seen in the recent Turkish election, where a leader of the Kurdish minority had been jailed and actually came in third to President Erdogan with regard to that particular presidential race. So let us hope and push for the idea that Mr. Lula da Silva can run for president, because if Mr. Bolsonaro triumphs, there will be dark days ahead. Not only dark days ahead for the Brazilian masses, but also keep in mind this would be in league with regional tendencies. The fact that President de Kirchner of Argentina was supplanted and replaced by President Macri, who was to her right. The fact that in neighboring Chile, a socialist leader was deposed in favor of a right-wing millionaire, multimillionaire in an election. Or what's going on in Venezuela right now, where Mr. Maduro is currently under siege, or in Nicaragua right now. So this is a very dangerous turn of events and represents a turnaround from the optimism of a few years ago when all of us were talking about this turn to the left in Latin America. Although, to be fair, I should mention the elections in Mexico, where President López Obrador will be taking office on December 1st. In a monumentally significant victory for the left.
It's really quite a stunning turn of events. You have the Workers' Party won four consecutive elections, majority elections, a majority vote. By all accounts, including those of international observers, these were free and fair elections. They're gone. They're toppled. People who were not elected and who represent the past in the worst possible way are in the ascension, in spite of the fact that they won the majority vote, the Workers' Party. The Workers' Party leader in prison, Dilma Rousseff, cast off and cast out from a legislative coup d'etat. And here you have a Bolsonaro, one, embracing the open racism and the slavocracy, that terrible tradition in Brazil. Perhaps, and you correct me if I'm wrong, the greatest importer of African enslaved people of all countries in the Western Hemisphere, and from the U.S. media, the corporate-owned media, kind of a deafening silence or a carefully nurtured apathy about the event, perhaps hoping that Bolsonaro, in fact, takes the reins.
Well, I'm afraid you're onto something. You are correct with regard to the ignominious record that Brazil has with regard to importing enslaved African workers. That is to say that slavery was not abolished in Brazil until 1888, 23 years after the conclusion of the U.S. Civil War. Although, as I point out in my book, it's interesting to note that after the end of the U.S. Civil War, there were a number of U.S. slave owners who did not want to give up slavery, and with their Africans in tow, moved en masse to Brazil. And there is still remnants of that population in Brazil. That is to say, slave owners from Dixie, and I should also say black people from Dixie, who are now in Brazil as of 2018. And what's striking as well is that tradition continues under President Temer. That is to say that his cabinet was quite striking in the worst way. Pale, male, and stale, as it has been described. That is to say, in one of the most racially and ethnically diverse nations on planet Earth, all of his cabinet members could fairly be described as being white men. Not only white men, but conservative white men. And this is something that the right wing would like to continue. And sadly enough, they seem to have the dominant sector of the military behind them.
Yeah, and under the current political situation, Temer, who you mentioned, who replaced Dilma Rousseff, I mean, his approval rating is in, you know, single digits, less than 10%. People are dissatisfied. The economy is having and has been enduring all kinds of problems. It seems kind of like a perfect storm. Destabilization, no, you know, popular leadership. A strong man, a man on a horse, the military. I mean, precisely under these kind of circumstances, throughout history do we see the military seizing the power, perhaps creating the instability itself and then seizing the power and then trying to represent itself to the public as the stabilizer? You see it that way?
Well, I'm afraid so. And what's even more striking is the reference you made to the role of the U.S. press, which likes to portray itself as a defender of human rights and prattles incessantly about human rights. And yet you have the largest country in South America on the verge of moving decisively to the right with a neo-fascist leader, with the militaries eager and anxious to exit the barracks in case there is any discontent. And yet you hardly see or hear anything about this in the corporate media. I should also say that perhaps accidentally, the Trump team has given a jolt of adrenaline to the Brazilian economy, because with the trade war with China, what you have seen is that China now is moving to purchase Brazilian soybeans as opposed to soybeans from U.S. Midwestern farmers. Hopefully, that will not be a factor in helping to boost Mr. Bolsonaro into the highest office in the land in Brazil.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from Houston by Dr. Gerald Horn. He's a professor of history at the University of Houston, the author of many books, including The Deepest South, The United States, Brazil, and the African Slave Trade. I really encourage people to find Dr. Gerald Horn, that's H-O-R-N-E, online, and to look at his books. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. If you're in the Washington, D.C. area, you can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM and 1390 AM. You can hear us at SputnikNews.com, and you can subscribe to this as a podcast at iHeartRadio, iTunes Radio, and at Spreaker. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and clear.